From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Before addressing topic one on the minds of postal and federal employees and related community, and that is the deliberations on almost $51 billion in benefit cuts, I should mention that this week the Postal Board of Governors will be meeting, and earlier this week, the Washington Post revealed that the board, in consultation with the White House, has settled on David Steiner to succeed Louis DeJoy as Postmaster General. Steiner is currently serving on the board of directors of the FedEx Corporation and was formerly the chief executive officer of a national waste management company. It is unclear when Steiner will clear the official vetting process, but it usually does not take an extended amount of time. The vetting has traditionally been conducted by the Postal Inspection Service. Upon the completion of vetting, the Board of Governors will likely make an official announcement on a new Postmaster General. Stay posted. Now let me introduce this week's Naps Chat guest, John Hatton. John is no stranger to Naps Chat listeners. He is also a friend and colleague. John currently serves as Staff Vice President for Policy and Programs at the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees, a.k.a. NARF. He has vast experience relating to issues confronting the federal workforce. Moreover, John was formerly co-chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Federal Postal Coalition, which is comprised of over 30 organizations that represent more than 5 million active and retired federal and postal employees across the country. John has been working in NARF's legislative operations for about 15 years. Welcome back to Naps Chat, John.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
As I just mentioned, we've both been representing federal employed public workers for a very long time. And periodically, within Congress, the specter of budget reconciliation raises its evil head. John, what is budget reconciliation, and why does it present such a dire threat to individuals who we represent?
Well, it's a congressional process that allows, for our purposes and relevant purposes, allows a bill to be passed with just 50 votes plus the vice president in the Senate. So it bypasses the filibuster. And to do that, Congress passes a budget resolution, and then that has reconciliation instructions to the committee. So what they're doing with reconciliation is reconciling the spending levels they set in the budget with the policies that they're going to enact via those instructions. So for our purposes, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee has instructions to cut $50 billion or more in mandatory spending from programs under its jurisdiction, which, lo and behold, are federal retirement and health benefits. And what we saw them do last week was pass a bill that, pursuant to those instructions, that cut a number of earned benefits for federal and postal employees.
We'll talk a little bit about those benefit cuts in a couple of minutes, but I want to go back a little bit. And the components of the committee-approved budget reconciliation language, which we'll talk about, should not have been a surprise to our members, that is, NARF members and NAPS members.
Right.
Before coming over here to NARF headquarters, I took a quick peek at NARF's and NAPS's printed and digital material that we have shared with our members since January, since the beginning of January. To our credit, our organizations anticipated the attacks on our benefits and that are now being advanced by the committee. Can you summarize what those approved cuts were that we anticipated?
Sure, and I'll even do one better. One of the things that was within the list of options, I think due to some of our efforts across the board, was left out. So there was a list that was circulated within Congress, and I received this from a congressional staffer. It was also leaked to Punchbowl News. What wound up being in this reconciliation bill from the Oversight and Government Reform Committee was right in line with what was in those lists of options that was circulated in January. So we've been talking about these specifics. What was actually in this bill was an increasing retirement contributions for employees up to 4.4%. So for anybody hired before 2013, for those hired after that, they have increased contributions. Anybody hired before 2013 would basically see a 3.6% pay cut. What passed the committee has a phase in over 2 years, 2026 and 27. There is a provision where if you leave your probationary period as an employee, you have a choice. You can take an additional 5% pay cut through increased retirement contributions or be at will and have no merit-based civil service protections. There is a provision to completely eliminate the FERS annuity supplement, which is if you are eligible for early retirement before you're eligible for Social Security, it's an additional amount you earn. That would apply as of the date of enactment. And so for somebody who's taken, you know, a deferred resignation offer, so somebody who's about to retire, they would lose that benefit. It goes changes retirement calculations from the high three to the high five. That is a reduction in your retirement benefits. That applies to anybody who retires after January 1st, 2027. There are some exemptions for those subject to mandatory retirement. They would add a fee for merit-based Merit System Protection Board appeals. And those are the main ones we're concerned about.
I want to explore something with you for a moment. The phase-in of the increased contribution, that was not sort of obvious in the legislative language.
Yeah. So there was the first print, and then they changed it with the amendment and the nature of the substitute. And so it's the dates in which they are applicable is phase-in. So it would be a 1.8% increase in 26 and 1.8% in 27. For people. So I think for us, the worst cases here are for people who have been, one, relying on this as they're planning an existing retirement. So if somebody took a deferred resignation offer as part of these reductions in force, and now, you know, before that kicks in, let's say they're planning to retire September 30th, you're going to have this potentially enacted before that. And then what they relied on for that offer is not the case. The second worst is anybody vested. You have earned part of your retirement benefit from past service. So taking away for somebody about to retire, or even just with any vested benefits, you're really rolling back something that you have already earned through your past service. This isn't about your future service and the future benefits that you receive. You know, you can make those choices. And so those two things. And then what they're also doing is, while at the same time they are giving you less, they're asking you to pay more for less by increasing those retirement contributions. So it all just adds into one really big stinky bill.
Let me come back to something. You referenced this punch bowl news leak, yeah, or whatever. In February, about 3 months, yeah, ago, this document was actually developed by the Ways and Means Committee, as I recall. Or they circulated.
They circulated it,
the document. And they provided that document to the House leadership and to the respective committees in the House, including the Oversight and Accountability Committee. And this was provided because they were looking for a menu of cuts that would offset the trillions of dollars of bloated tax cuts that, yep, the Ways and Means Committee wanted to pass at the, right, request of President Trump. And these cuts were embedded in the House passed budget resolution.
Yep.
House Conres 14, which we now NARF and NAPS immediately energized our grassroots to oppose that budget resolution,
right,
because we anticipated what was going to happen.
Right.
But as you recall, the knee-jerk reaction by a lot of Republicans who were at the other end of our digital communications said that, well, the resolution was merely a blueprint and that we should wait and see what happens. Hey, was that your experience also? And at this moment, do we feel vindicated for warning our people?
Yes, we're vindicated. I heard some of that where, you know, this is just what we're, yeah, that's some type of blueprint, and it's not the final deal, and we'll assess the policies. And I do think that we are beginning to see the pushback from some who, you know, are saying, Republicans in the House, some Republicans are saying this is not what they signed up for. And that includes Mike Turner of Ohio, who in committee voted against this. Langworthy from New York decided not to vote for it. There was no public statement on why he didn't do that. But our hope is that that was, and some intel is that that was because of these cuts. So, yeah, I think it was clear what they were doing, not just from leaked documents, from Ways and Means, but the budget resolution itself was specific in what they wanted to do. It provided the outline and the blueprint of everything that they wanted to do. It was very clear that for $50 billion in cuts from oversight and government reform, it was very clear where they had to go. They didn't have any other options. There wasn't they couldn't kind of hide behind some other alternative that they didn't know about. You know, these were the options that were laid out, and there's no other options within their jurisdiction that they could really get that type of money from. So, you know, we've seen the House take two votes on this resolution. We've seen the Senate support it as well. So these people are on record supporting the blueprint. So it's really on them. If they were making that line that this is not what we intended, well, now is their time to vote against and oppose these provisions and make sure they stay out of the bill.
Yeah. Yeah, I just remember, you know, we said, well, it's merely a blueprint. Because I put little quotations around that, and it reminds me of, I don't know if folks out there listening to us, and you might recall, there's the scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail where upon being dismembered by King Arthur, the Black Knight, you know, continuing to taunt King Arthur saying, this is merely a flesh wound. And I'm just saying that merely a blueprint doesn't resonate with me.
Right. It's a clear blueprint. It's very clear what they're trying to do, and they're going about trying to enact it. So they may have some problems having the policies line up with the blueprint, but they took – anybody who voted for that budget resolution was voting for this direction. They were voting to have the oversight committee come up with these types of policies. So I totally agree with you there. You know, this is a larger plan where they want to extend the first Trump administration's tax cuts, increase spending on defense, increase spending on immigration, enforcement, and border security, and then mitigate the amount of deficit increases, not eliminate, mitigate the amount of deficit increases with other spending cuts, including from federal employee and postal employee benefits.
Now, we have a heavy lift right now. We have to fight this, the budget reconciliation process and the Budget Reconciliation Act, if and when it advances beyond the committees and onto that floor of the House. And I want to talk about advocacy strategies, if I can. Mm-hmm. Although I think we both would agree face-to-face meetings are the most effective means of influencing Congress, telephonic communications less so, but both NARTH and NAPS have embraced digital communications as a primary tool of legislative advocacy, and we both use a company known as Voter Voice as part of our digital platform. Could you talk about the effectiveness of digital advocacy, particularly in this fast-paced and somewhat treacherous legislative environment?
Yeah, I think the advantage of digital advocacy is that it's pretty easy to do. So if you want to run up the numbers on how many people are contacting a congressional office, we call it our Legislative Action Center. It's run on Voter Voice.
That's what we call it also, Legislative Action Center.
So, you know, we can direct people to that Action Center. It's very easy because you know, especially once you've done it once, your address information is in there, it's saved, and you have a message that's pre-written that can go to that member of Congress. So it helps us increase the number of contacts with the member of Congress to show the quantity of people impacted. Now, we also tell our members to personalize it as much as possible because surveys of congressional staff show that personalization helps in terms of them paying attention to it. And, you know, so are in-person meetings, so are calls. You know, I think what the biggest impact of the digital is how much attention you can get and how many the size of the contacts you can get through that.
But also through the digital advocacy, we could tailor the message to a targeted legislative staff person who actually handles the issue. If you call the office, you're not necessarily going to get the legislative staff person handling the issue dealing with the budget or with federal and postal employee issues.
Right.
Through the magic of digital advocacy, we can direct that message right to the right person.
Yeah, and we can also target to committee members. So what we did in advance of the committee vote was we sent a broadcast out to all of our members that were in congressional districts that had members on the House Oversight Committee. And so it's directing the staffer is a great strategy too for digital. and being able to target with it is also helpful.
Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about the committee and what happened at that committee markup or that committee meeting last on April 30th. All the Democrats at the meeting opposed the cuts.
Yeah.
However, as you mentioned before, only one Republican member, Michael Turner, actually was present and voted against it. Representative Langworthy, I don't believe, was took a pass on voting and wasn't at the meeting. Were you surprised by the votes?
No, I was very certain that the Democrats were all going to vote against it, and I was pretty sure if they're going to bring it up, they were going to have most of the Republican votes. Turner has always been somebody, he has a lot of federal employees in his district, right at Patterson Air Force Base in his district. I was certainly pleased to see that he voted against it. I wasn't shocked, and I think I knew the day before that he was going to vote against it because he was about to put a press release out. But even getting Langworthy to take a pass was good. You know, I think it shows that our advocacy, the digital advocacy that our members do, can have an impact. I think these members have been hearing it, and they're going to hear it more now that these details are out there. And so I think particularly from the postal community, you're all over the country and well spread out. And so you can hit every – I mean, there's a lot of members of Congress that your community can touch and hit. And I think it'll be a really, really effective part of the strategy here of getting in front of them. The one other positive thing from this hearing that was a nice surprise going into it was that they did not include a provision to turn FEHB into a voucher program. And that was a little surprising, a nice surprise. That was one of those one of those options on their list, and the one that probably would have had the most savings. It would have hit current retirees as well, and that really would have forced you to pay more and more year after year for those earned health benefits as healthcare inflation went up higher and the increase in the voucher went up by a more modest consumer price inflation amount.
As we sit down and talk today, the Republicans in the House, possibly in the Senate also, are stuck between two distinct and vocal minorities within the Republican conference, which in their own ways, each of those minorities exercise tremendous power, the far-right Freedom Caucus and the Republican moderates. And the disagreement involves the magnitude of Medicaid cuts and whether the cap on deductibility of state and local taxes can be raised, and by how much. For our community, our Republican allies, which are generally within the moderate camp, moderate Republicans, they're very involved in the SALT, state and local tax issue. How do you think that confluence of state and local taxes and the cap deductibility cap plays into our messaging? Because we're messaging the same members of Congress.
Yeah, I think it actually presents us with a little bit of a challenge because people who would normally be, you know, if this is a standalone vote, voting against these provisions have other priorities in this fight. And so there may be members who are the most likely to be our allies here that have a very high priority on the SALT deductions, a very high priority on limiting how much the cuts are to Medicaid. And so I think we need to identify them, those individuals, to hopefully encourage them to work with us on this third issue as a top priority, but also identify and work with individuals who maybe have a lot of federal employees in their district but are less centrist to help us and lead this fight. So I think those individuals will be part of the process, but I think it becomes more challenging to get them to fall on their sword just for this issue when they have other higher priorities.
Which brings me to a conversation we had yesterday, because yesterday both of us participated in a meeting with a Republican moderate office about reconciliation without divulging which particular office we spoke with. You know, and we talked about these issues, which you just related to, how Medicaid cuts and the SALT, the state and local tax issue, plays into our messaging. What's your takeaway? Was your takeaway from that meeting with the Republican member?
I think it was similar to what I kind of explained, where clearly, and that particular member didn't have a lot of federal employees in their district, and you look at some other centrist ones, they have a few more, where I think they would probably be on our side and maybe join a grouping of it, but they're probably not going to be leading opposition on on these cuts. So I think it's piecing together enough opposition and getting a kind of a cohort of 10 to 20 or so members that are pressing on this. And I think I've heard from a few members in the last few days, either directly or, you know, through a secondary or intermediary, that the concerns about these provisions goes beyond just those centrists and does focus and fall within, you know, individuals who potentially have more feds in their district.
The importance of that issue and how that we don't need to reach that many people is because of the narrowness of the Republican majority in the House of Representatives. So you don't have to win 30 or 40 Republican votes or convince them to hold out their vote on this issue. We probably only need like 5 or 6.
Right. And I think just by the numbers, we have 4 people who say, I'm not voting for this if this is in there. We get it. I think it's harder to have 4 people who say this is their one issue and they're going to hold the entire bill for it. Whereas if you give them support with maybe 10 or so total people, I think it's a stronger position to be in. But yeah, I mean, the actual numbers are very slim in the House. And so it is this real push and pull between the centrists and the far right Freedom Caucus, because every time you take away some of the savings from the spending cuts, Speaker Johnson is running into complaints from his right wing that they're not cutting the deficit or they're increasing the deficit too much as part of this bill.
It's a legislative game of whack-a-mole, almost.
Yeah.
I just want to change gears for a minute. One of our champions in Congress is ranking Democrat on the Oversight and Accountability Committee, Jerry Connolly, and he recently announced he was not going to seek reelection and he intends to vacate the top Democratic position on the committee. He formerly served as a subcommittee chair that held our issues. We've both worked very closely with the congressman over the years. Any thoughts on his departure from Congress?
Well, I think it's really sad. He's been an incredible champion for the federal workforce and for the Postal Service and for postal employees. And he has not just put his energy and his will into it, but his intellect. He was a former congressional staffer, and he knew the issues well, and he really dove into them. And he was a friend of NARF and certainly a friend of the postal community. And certainly we wish him well in his battle with cancer, and hopefully he's still able to recover. And it's just a retirement from Congress. So nothing but good things to say about Congressman Connolly.
Agreed. So, John, what are you going to be doing for the next 30 days? Any vacation plans?
No. We're trying to get in front of as many members of Congress on this issue on reconciliation as possible. There's also a lot going on with executive actions related to the federal workforce that we're dealing with as well, whether it's we're involved in some lawsuits. We're involved in trying to put pressure and oversight over some of these activities with these large-scale reductions in force, and also making sure our members who are dealing with that or potential members have the resources they need to make the best decisions for themselves possible.
These are busy times for us.
They sure are.
With that, I want to thank John Hatton, that he's the NARF vice president, for joining me this week to discuss some very critical issues for all postal and federal employees and retirees. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also, I want to thank Naps Chat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy Naps Chat, please leave a positive review in whatever podcast store you're using. And more importantly, share Naps Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe and stay healthy.
And make